This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. Quick note before we get started with today's episode. Of course, some of you will know we've had quite a few people reach out though. So I guess we didn't really announce it, but we have moved to a bit of a summer schedule where we will be releasing shows bi-weekly just until the end of August. And then come September, we're back to our regular weekly schedule. So yeah, just we'll highlight that. But we've got a fantastic episode today. We've got Tom Story on the show. Tom Story, of course, is a prominent real estate agent in Toronto. He is the leader of the Story team. He also is the co-host of the Tom Story Show, which is a popular YouTube show and podcast that focuses both on Vancouver and Toronto real estate, often kind of comparing and contrasting. And that's what we're doing on the show today.
It's interesting because the Tom Story Show, I mean, Steve Karash is the co-host, friend of the show. He's a Fraser Valley realtor. So,
yes.
So I feel like they focus a lot on the Valley. Yeah. Is it fair to say Tom Story is a YouTube star? I think he is.
I think he is. Yeah. He's done incredibly well on YouTube.
He might have done well going to Hollywood.
Right.
Instead. But a very smart analyst and very smart agent. I feel like he packages things in a very concise and intelligent way. And we talk about what he's seeing on the ground in Toronto and how it compares to Vancouver. And, you know, for very different markets across the country, there's a lot of similarities. So stay tuned for that. This is a good one.
Yeah, and my favorite part of today's episode, Matt, we talk about lessons learned from the downturn in the market, what you would still buy, tips for buyers in this market, tips for sellers in this market. There's a ton of useful takeaways for not only people that are thinking of buying or selling, but also investors, also other agents that listen to the show. So stick around. This is jam-packed full of takeaways. So but Matt, before we get to that.
Yeah, before we get to that, well, we got the realist headlines. That's Howard
Chai's
Substack growing like crazy. Speaking of another all-star, Adam, you got those headlines for the week.
Yeah, Matt. So headline number one is the city of Surrey has announced a new site for its city center arena where the Vancouver Giants will be the anchor tenant. So notably, the new site was acquired via a land swap agreement with developer West Group, friends of the show, Bo Jarvis. And two, the Supreme Court has denied Montrose Properties' attempt to reopen the Cowichan tribe's ruling, which was big news. Three was home sales saw a 9.6 year-over-year increase in June in Greater Vancouver. Well, the Fraser Valley saw a year-over-year decrease of 4%, according to the stats published two weeks ago. We're actually bringing Steve Karash, friend of the show and co-host of the Tom Story Show, on to talk about the Fraser Valley soon. So we're just locking in a date. And so excited about that, excited to tackle the Fraser Valley. And last but not least, for headlines this week, Bonus Properties has listed its landmark development project at 800 to 876 Granville Street in downtown Vancouver, which includes the Commodore building, where I was just at a watch party recently. Pretty spectacular.
Horsehair, Adam. The horsehair is important in the flooring there.
That's horsehair?
You didn't know that?
No.
That is the acoustics. Yeah, is... So I believe they put horsehair in the flooring. Maybe I dreamt this. I'm pretty sure somebody might correct me. There is horsehair in the flooring at the Commodore, and it was done back when it was built, I believe, for acoustics. Although, does that make sense? I don't know. Maybe I should think these things through.
Yeah. It's weird to just say horsehair and then just pause. as if everyone's like, oh yeah, the flooring, right? It's the Commodore.
Right. Right. Spongy flooring at the Commodore. That is interesting. But Adam, let's move on to the segment that remains nameless.
Yes.
Because today, this is Wednesday, we're doing this. The Bank of Canada, as I'm sure you know, held the overnight rate again. And that was announced this morning. So I went through the analysis of the decision-making process, and I came up with a quiz question for you, Adam. So we know they held the rate, but here's the question. The Bank of Canada released its rate decision and monetary policy report this morning. Adam, this is a very simple one. True or false? The bank cited deteriorating Canadian housing activity as still an issue that they were worried about. True or false? But before we get to that, Adam, you have a listing you want to highlight from VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yeah, Matt, 1924 Kitchener Street. So anyone that knows Grandview Woodlands knows that the 1900 block of Kitchener is like prime location right by Victoria Park there, but tucked in. So it's nice and quiet. I love the between Victoria and Nanaimo because it feels very residential, but you're still a stone's throw to the drive. You don't have to deal with the congestion of the drive. Anyways, this is the best pocket. There's three suites in this house. So 2,700 square foot home with three really great suites, a two bedroom, one bath, a three bedroom, one bath, and another two bed, one bath. So three suites. Excellent for rental, but also easy to convert back to a single family dwelling. And if you want to learn more about that one or see photos of the house, it is over on our site, Scalina Real Estate or Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. And the list price is $1,899. So just tucked under $1.9 million. Good value, incredible value. So check it out.
Fantastic value, fantastic location. So Adam, once again, true or false, the Bank of Canada cited deteriorating housing activity as an issue they are monitoring at this point, and that's part of the reason why they left their overnight rate unchanged.
Well, Matt, I have not read, other than opening up my email to see what the Bank of Canada had done this morning, which I expected the hold. I didn't read into it, so I'm going to go true, though.
Adam, the answer is false. The bank's exact read was housing activity, quote, has been weak, but looks to be stabilizing.
Oh, now,
I wonder if they saw the June stats, because I feel like that would be the read from the June stats here in Vancouver as well. Of course, they're looking right across the country, but that to me is a very positive sign when the Bank of Canada is starting to see stabilization in the housing market. But speaking of the housing market, maybe we should cut to our talk with Tom Story from Toronto to get his take on the Toronto real estate market and compare and contrast.
This one is a great episode. Stay tuned. Zentera has done it again. Recently named Multifamily Home Builder of the Year by the Home Builders Association of Vancouver and the Canadian Home Builders Association of BC. Zentera continues to move forward on new projects. And their latest, Butte, a new condo community in West Clayton, is now selling. With construction already underway, buyers can purchase with confidence knowing that the project is moving forward.
Butte offers 1, 2, and 3-bedroom condos located just 3 blocks to the future SkyTrain, Adam. These condos come with tons of inclusions like gas ranges, air conditioning, and designer-selected finishes. Residents will have access to the rooftop patio, fitness center, on-site daycare, co-working space, games room, and tons of outdoor space with 3 playgrounds. Estimated completion is summer 2028.
The best deals are happening now. Visit Zentera's home store in South Surrey to get all the details or check out the floor plans at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown, and we're the founders of Oakwin Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakwin, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with Tom Story. He is the leader of the Story team in Toronto, a very successful real estate team in the GTA. And of course, host of Tom Story Show, very popular podcast that you cover not only Toronto, but almost right across the country. You do a lot on Vancouver as well. Matt and I have both fortunately been guests on your show. It's great having you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, boys. I'm excited to be back. I did your show a few years ago. And
yeah,
I just got to tell you, it's nice to do podcasts with someone other than Steve for once, you know, just switch things up. People that have good attitudes. Yeah, no, I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to figure out what we're going to talk about.
You know, it's interesting, but you and Steve, different personalities.
Yeah.
You're kind of, you're like the warm hug of the show. And then Steve is, I love how he... The hard punch. Yeah, he's, and I love watching him engage with the comments on YouTube. Very few people are willing to do that, I think.
One of the best things he does is he'll engage with the comments. And then when he's proud of himself with one of his responses, he'll screenshot it and he'll put it as his Instagram story. And so many people are like, Steve, I don't care about your listings. I don't care about anything else you're posting. Just keep posting those. That's what we enjoy. I stay out of it. I think everyone's entitled to their opinion, and I go on with my day.
That's great. Yeah,
I feel like that would, it would ruin my day is what it would do, engaging with comments of any kind. So yeah, more power to him, but not for the faint of heart. Tom, can you maybe, I mean, we just kind of covered what you do, but for our listeners, can you talk a little bit about yourself? Tell us about yourself and how you got into real estate.
Yeah, so I started real estate January 2014. So coming up on 13-ish years now in the industry. Got my license when I was 22 years old. I am no longer 22 years old. So it's been a bit of a change over the time. Turning 35 this summer. Pretty much work city of Toronto exclusively. Like Toronto proper is where we do most of our business. We built a team now. You know, between editors and assistants and everyone else in total, there's like 8 or 9 of us right now. So we've kind of built over the years and do a lot of condo sales downtown, very, very active in that side of the market. And then lots of upsizers as well. So yeah, it's been a fun ride. And then obviously doing the podcast with Steve, running my own YouTube channel, watching the market evolve and educating myself so much more on what's going on by forcing myself to record videos every week, I think has been a massive help for my business. Not just because my education level gets better, but because it's allowed me to meet new people. Like I had 2 calls this morning from people that are both like, "Hey, I watch your videos. We want to buy a place." I'm like, "Great, you called the right person, right?" So that's basically what it's been like the last 13 years.
And Tom, I'm curious because you got into real estate really young. What was the draw? And how'd you get started?
When I was growing up, my mother was in sales, but never in real estate sales. And I remember very distinctively when she quit her corporate job and started her own business and she worked out of our basement. And it meant that, like, I remember this very clearly, like early in my life, that I didn't have to go to daycare anymore after school. I could just go home because my mom was there. And I remember like the very early seeds of thinking like, oh, that's cool. Like she's in charge or she gets to decide, you know, and then you learn further in the future. Once you actually do it, you're like, actually you give away way more of your time and it's way more difficult. So I'd always decided I went to university of Guelph. And as I was graduating, it wasn't like I had this massive love for houses or architecture. Like, I think I liked the business side of it, but I was like, you know what? I'm 22. I had just graduated. I started doing my license. I figured like, I'm just going to go all in now. I was living with my parents literally in their basement when I got my real estate license, tried to save up so that I wouldn't have to pay rent and bought my first little condo. And then one of the things that we have here in Toronto that I know is slightly different from your market is realtors can do rentals here and you can like survive early in your career. So I built up my entire clientele by doing rentals, running ads on Kijiji and Craigslist and meeting strangers and helping them rent places. And then that over time kind of builds up to all those people came back as first time home buyers. And now we're helping them buy their second property to move to the house because they're having kids. So it's been a really fun kind of evolution over the years that I think it was good that I started so young because I didn't know anything. I was like super naive about it. I'm like, oh, this will just work. And thankfully it did.
And you were right.
Well, thank goodness, because there's no other skills around here anymore. This is it. So.
And do you still do rentals, your team?
Our team does. Yeah, we'll still do over 100 rental transactions a year. It's
wow.
When kind of the formula of our team is whenever we bring on a new team member, they become the rental person. Because a lot of our clients own investment properties, so there's helping them rent out and find tenants on the landlord side. And then a way to keep busy and kind of put food on the table. Like, you're not making massive money from this, but to keep yourself going early stages of real estate, a lot of realtors will do rentals.
And does that translate into like actually managing the property, or is it more just like placing a tenant and then you're done?
Some realtors have built big property management businesses surrounding it as well. We purposely didn't do that. So we find you the tenant, but you're managing the property.
Gotcha.
Interesting. So Tom, maybe I'm just thinking like a jumping off point here. We're literally kind of halfway through July. I feel like there's been a lot of talk about Vancouver and Toronto over the last 3 years being kind of the epicenters of the downturn. How's the market there? And specifically in the areas that you're looking at, the GTA, Toronto proper, the condo market.
It's so confusing. Like, that question used to at least be somewhat easy to answer. Like, generally, it was like, oh, it's pretty good, or yeah, it's really good, or it's really slow. But it's so property type and price point specific now. Like, the swings between what one section of the market's doing and another go from like intense seller's market to like a year of inventory. I think I've ever seen this much difference depending on what it is. So basically right now, like, I was just looking at the numbers that came out for June, and for the city of Toronto, we break it up. Like, as real estate agents, if you saw a map of the city, and I'm sure it's the same for you guys for Vancouver, we like put them into different zones. So for Toronto, if any listing starts with a C, it just means central. It probably means it's in like the middle of the city. E means east and W means west. And there's 35 distinct like zones, and then there's little neighborhoods in each zone. And last month, almost 80% of every zone in Toronto, on average, nothing was selling over the asking price. Everything was selling under asking. So generally, right, like if we were just talking about averages and what's going on, you're tracking like the headline numbers, it's a slow market. Like, almost 70% of our active listings in the city of Toronto have a strata fee. So condo apartments, condo townhouses are really clogging up the overall inventory if you're just talking about the entire market. And then you look at detached homes or semi-detached homes, which I know you guys would call duplexes in your market. Detached homes are sitting at like 3 months of inventory. Semis are like 2.5. And what we've noticed is of the 35 zones that exist in Toronto, there was only 6 that actually, on average, when properties are selling, are still going over the asking price. Now, they're only going over the asking price because they're listing low and holding offer dates, right? Like, it's not like they all just go over asking. It's manufactured. It's meant to be that way. And that's usually the argument, is like, they went over asking, but they were never going to take the price they were listed at, which I agree with. But I've always pointed to the fact, but like, yeah, but it works. Buyers are not willing to play that game if they have 14 houses to choose from, right? If there's 2 of them and they like one of them, they're going to bid on one and probably be up against other people. So I started digging further into it. I was like, okay, why is it that in a market that sales volume is almost at a 30-year low, you can't even give a small condo away no matter how low you put the price at? Why is there certain pockets of the city that are still feeling like, not prices, but feeling like 2021, 2022 on the competitive side as a buyer?
Yeah.
And what's interesting is when you look at it, the 3 areas were EO1, EO2, and EO3 on the East End. And basically, that's Leslieville, Riverdale, the Beaches, the Danforth, East York, You know, like if you know anything about Toronto, you probably have heard those neighborhoods before. And then it's funny, the other three that are all on the west end of the city are like High Park, Rauncey, The Junction, Bloor West Village, Dovercourt Village, all these areas that when you really break it down, and this is like a long answer to give you a very simple like reason why this is happening. These are single family homes that I would call these like first choice neighborhoods. So, you know, when you have a client that starts their search in the first conversation, it's like ideally where you want to live. 95% of the time, if we're talking to a buyer that's like upsizing, they're going to say one of these different neighborhoods. And they're good school districts, they're family oriented, they're family friendly, and they're still relatively close to downtown. I feel what happened is all these kind of newer parents that are pregnant or the second one's on the way, they've lived downtown for 5 to 10 years and now they're ready to buy the single family home, but they're not willing to go too far. Like they still want to be like relatively close. So yeah, so overall the market in Toronto, it's like the general market, you'll expect to see no price increases. Honestly, I don't think anytime soon. Smaller condos are still hurting. And I don't think that's going to change really for a couple of years at the earliest. Pre-construction condos are the worst of the worst. That's where the most damage has happened. And then single family homes, probably sub 1.5, but you could even argue up to 2 in some neighborhoods, are still getting multiple bids and selling in 7 days. So it just really depends on like, what do you want? What area do you want to be in? And what's the price point?
That's so funny. That's exactly what we've been talking about. Just our version probably of those neighborhoods, right? Your Kitsilano, your maybe Mount Pleasant, Fairview. Parts of the North Shore, Grandview Woodlands, like areas that are kind of like top tier, always highly desirable, kind of like the blue chip real estate combined with entry level end user product.
Yep.
Interesting.
And when you break it down even further, it's like the reason why these neighborhoods on average are going over asking isn't because the detached homes are doing it. Like detached homes are selling quickly. It's the what you guys would call duplexes. It's less expensive, but it still has all the amazing things that this other home has down the street that just so happens to be detached, but I can get it for 400 grand less and still get in that neighborhood. That's where the most competitive side of the market is happening.
Some people would say, you know, that these prices aren't missing middle prices, but they're kind like in the context of Toronto, it's basically that missing middle type product in great neighborhoods.
I mean, like, yeah, when you talk about, and these aren't massive houses, by the way, like our typical like downtown east or west semi-detached house, it could be 15 feet wide, right? Like it's 15 to like a 25 foot semi is huge in Toronto. I know it's different in different markets, but they're usually 20 feet wide or less, 100 deep. They're all the same floor plans, just flipped. Like every semi kind of looks the same just based on how they build them. But not including the basement, these are usually 1,300 to 1,700 square foot homes. Perfect. That are perfect for that family. And there's also, when I was thinking about this, I'm like, okay, it's obvious like these neighborhoods have always been in demand. But why is it now that there's such a discrepancy on them being so much more in demand than all the other asset classes? I think you just have to look at like who the buyer is. The buyer is not an investor looking at their spreadsheet, running the numbers. It's like, we're pregnant with our second kid and this is a school district we want to get in. Like we're buying something. Like it's an emotional buyer, which you could argue might pay more or get more involved in the bidding process because it's like, yeah, it's 50 grand more, but this is the third house we've bid on. And like our kids start school in September.
And 1700 or 2000 square foot homes are perfect because now like, you know, most people that we're helping, it is a 1 to 2 kid family. Like if you have 3 kids or more, it's like, what are you on a farm? Like, you know, it's like, there's not a lot of, it's a very different family dynamic as well now. Right. So that's so interesting. So then a couple of things you kind of highlighted. So one thing that you said that we've been saying is condos, like one bed condos, it's almost like you can't find bottom. So you're very much experiencing this the same thing there.
Yeah, we've run pretty extensive data on this for like every segment of the condo market. So your bachelor condos, which mostly none of them have parking spots anyways, they're sitting at like 10 to 12 months of inventory. Like it is, you can sell them, but it doesn't even really matter what the last one sold for, because like just keep subtracting from that, because the buyer pool is just so small. Like those were always sold from investor to investor. And if you're trying to sell it with a tenant still in it, like good luck. Like it's so, so difficult. So yeah, I believe that segment of the market is going to have to continuously keep dropping here. It's funny because they are still like technically the most affordable real estate you can buy, but no one has any interest in buying it. And because rents have come down as well, the investors that used to be the ones buying it, they're not interested. You look at one bedrooms, if they have a parking spot, they can sell. But even if you're bang on, you're 60 days on the market and it's going to take some time. A one plus den with parking is a bit of a sweet spot in the market, mostly in buildings that were built at least 10 years ago, but usually 15 plus years ago. And that's your like 650 to 750 square foot one plus den with parking in an established building that's not all rented out, that's mostly owner occupied. That's okay, but not great. And then there's like, you know, it's funny, I was chatting with a guy this morning that was looking to invest into the condo market, because we are starting to slowly get those calls now, but they don't want the bottom end stuff. They don't want the bachelor units. They're like, what's doing well now? Because if it's doing well now, it's going to be doing the best in 5 years as well. So we've kind of flipped the mindset on like, if you want to invest in Toronto condos, and this would probably work the same for your market, let's pretend you're not an investor. What would an end user be looking to buy right now? Because that's your buyer in 5-10 years that's going to buy your property. So for the end user product, it's basically 2-bed, 2-bath with parking over 800 square foot in these specific neighborhoods looking for these specific floor plans. And that's the part of the market that I would define as like the best of the worst. Like you're not seeing massive price drops anymore, but they're still selling usually in under 30 days if they meet all those criteria points.
It's striking how similar these markets are right now. Like I feel like if I was just listening to you, I would think you're talking about Vancouver in so many ways. Like I would rather have a 30-year-old 650 square foot one bed with den right now than a brand new, even good floor plan, 480 square foot one bed in a concrete tower. You know, like that, that is a sweet spot in the one bed market for sure. It's also interesting how the script has, or the logic has kind of flipped, right? Like that before it was like cheap and cheerful. Entry cost is kind of what everybody's focused on. Price per square foot, I guess, in terms of rent was important. Whereas now, I think everybody's been scarred, might be strong, but the downturn has kind of really, the tide's out. And it's like, okay, what do people actually want? You know, what has stood the test of time? And it's those larger units.
I think we've learned a good lesson here that like, there are certain property types that sell in markets that are only end user driven. And then there's investor properties. So if you're betting on the future of either of our markets right now, and you're wanting to get back in to the condo market, buying at, whether this is the bottom or it goes on further, but you're buying at a price that's obviously way lower than it previously was. You want to buy a condo, then in the future, the buyer, like I've almost switched my whole thinking on this. It's like, when you sell this in 5 or 10 years, who's the buyer? Because I can give you another like real example that we see. These larger units that are like, let's call it 1,000 to 1,500 square feet in older, even like 20, 30-year-old buildings, you'd be surprised how fast these sell. And it's like, that makes no sense, right? These used to be like, these things used to sit on the market. It's like, well, And inventory is not wildly low. Like there's enough to choose from. And then you start taking a step back. You're like, well, who's buying it? It's a downsizer that just sold their house and they're not impacted by mortgage rates. They're sitting on cash. So I've almost flipped my whole thinking to like, all those other things are obviously very important. Like, you know, floor plan and the rent that you're going to get and all the other factors you'd put into it. But if you're going to hold it forever, it's maybe a different conversation. But if the idea is I'm going to sell this in 10 years, I want to know who the buyer profile is going to be buying it. And are they going to be people that are impact? Because even though I do strongly believe like investors will return, hard to believe it's going to be even 50% of what we previously saw, right. at least right, for the right. next decade, right? Like they'll come back, but not like it was.
So another thing, Tom, we've been talking about and thinking about a lot is it's obviously can be a fantastic time to move through the market and specifically move up the market. And it's tricky because a lot of people also, if they're in condo units, they're feeling trapped right now because they can't sell. Are you seeing that in Toronto, this idea of people that maybe have to sell something to buy something and just being in a position where they're just unable to execute? It might make sense with the numbers, but just, you know, at the end of the day, it's getting sold.
That's 50% of my business. So I've become very good at having yeah. those initial conversations of, and it's tough, right? Because it's like, typically they're selling a property type like a condo, even if it's a 2-bedroom, that they bought 5 years ago, 7 years ago, 10 years ago. But most condos in Toronto are selling at 2018 prices right now, like maybe 2019 for some property types. So the first thing is like, okay, it's not worth much more than you paid, if not being worth a lot less than you paid, depending on when you bought it. And then what you want to go buy next is probably in one of those 6 neighborhoods we talked about, and you're going to be competing with 8 other people on each property. And they're like, what? I feel like I'm at the worst side. I'm like entering the most competitive market and trying to sell the side of the market that's the most difficult. So what we're doing a lot now is we're going to them and going, okay, if you have to sell first, you know, assuming that there's equity in the property and they can make the move, because if there's no equity in the property, then the conversation becomes, well, if you sell it now, you're just realizing your loss. Can you afford to hold on to this and just rent it out and make the next jump without selling it? But there's lots of people that can't do that and then would be stuck because then they have no other option. But for the people that have the equity in it and they don't love the price, but they can do it, what we're saying now is like, okay, let's say the last one sold for $825 for that same unit. I would say, hey, go to your mortgage broker, tell them that you're going to sell this condo for $775. I'm going to give you a very conservative number. Let's work off that number. Based on that, what would you be approved for the next property? And then I got this idea years ago from a realtor in Collingwood. And he said, before you ever show buyers properties, like get them and show them anything, send them a reverse search. And all it is pulling a list of properties that have sold in the last 30 days that fall in their criteria. So basically it's like, go to your mortgage broker, assuming you're going to sell for less than you actually think and get pre-approved for the next purchase. That's step one. Then once you tell me the neighborhoods you want to buy and then you tell me your criteria, I'm going to send you a list of, let's say, the last 10 properties that have sold. You can see the sale price and you can see the house. Go through that list and tell me if you would have bought any of those homes if you were ready when they came to the market. And I found that exercise is probably saving me hours and hours and hours of explanation and what's going on in the market. And it's cool because, you know, the husband and wife will sit down and they'll email me back on the list they send. And they're like, okay, we wouldn't have bought any on this list. It's like, okay, then maybe we don't put the condo up for sale yet because, or can we increase the price point? But if they come back, like I just did this last week, it's actually funny. It was someone that was referred to me that's selling their condo in Kelowna right now, having a little bit of difficulty selling their condo in Kelowna, which I guess is not news to you guys. And they're moving to Toronto and they have to sell that one first. He's like, hey, I want to be ready when this condo sells that I can jump on something. I sent him a list and he's like, I would have bought like 8 of the 10 of them. I would have considered making an offer on. I'm like, great.
Wow.
We know what we're looking for and you're happy with it. So maybe that's a bit of a long-winded answer to tell you like, yeah, this situation happening a lot. Like I really believe it's the biggest opportunity in the market right now. The upsize, if you're financially in a place to do it, you're likely, you know, I don't want to like guarantee anything, but you're likely going to regret it in the next 3 to 5 years if you want to get to the next one now, because it's going to be more expensive if your current property goes up as well.
Right. And just to continue down that line of reasoning on the people that are trapped in the market, What about you're dealing, you're a big brand in the downtown market. Obviously, you're a big brand in the condo market. People are approaching you in markets where there's tons of inventory and you can't find bottom. How are you approaching a listing like that right now?
Yeah. So we've actually like dubbed this formula for Toronto condos. You guys are welcome to steal it and call it your own. It's called the stamp formula. And we go through the criteria points of what we believe is important. Like what is making a condo sell or not sell in today's market? S is size. So it has to be over 600 square feet. That gets you a check mark. T is tenancy. Who's currently living in it? If it's vacant or owner occupied, you get a check. If it's currently tenanted, you get an X, right? A is asking price, which we'll come back to. M is maintenance fees. And P is parking. If I look back at all my condo sales this year that sold in under 2 weeks on the market, they were all at least 4 out of 5s. But most were 5 out of 5. So when you go through that, it's like, okay, let's just say it's a difficult sale, right? We're a smaller unit. It's vacant. It doesn't have a parking spot. Maintenance fees are okay, but they're not great. The only thing that we can solve for in that equation is asking price. We're in control of that. The other things we have no control over, the property is what it is. And then again, we're really just taking a different approach where we're flipping it. And I'm pulling up my computer and sitting with a seller and going, okay, in a declining market, you want to be the next sale. Everyone wants to feel like they're not giving their property away or you know, they're getting the best outcome for their property. But if you wait and the next one sells before you, then you're chasing that one down. So with the escalator analogy I found is the best one. Like if you get on an escalator at a mall, the only way to get off the escalator is to sell your house. But if you hold on too long and you hope for something that doesn't exist, you're going to end up in the basement and you're still going to be holding your house, right? When everyone else was slowly getting off the escalator at different stops because they would take a price that they didn't love, but then it keeps sliding down and you don't want to get stuck at the bottom. Like
they're off, yeah,
holding the bag, right? Like, so that's the analogy. And like, and that doesn't get through with every seller, but really what we're doing is going, if you were a buyer, let's take a look at what's actively for sale that we're actively competing with. Let's say there's 20 options. We know right now for your property type, if you have a smaller unit, let's say it is a bachelor condo and it's a tough sale right now. We know that there's 10 months of inventory. So 1 in 10 is selling every 30 days. Well, if there's 20 on the market, we need to be in the top 3 choices. Like we have no other choice. If we're not in the top 3 choices, you're not even showing up in the radar. And that usually goes over very well. Like people, I think enough time has passed now that when I tell people prices, no one's like jumping for joy. The best is like, oh, I didn't. Okay, it's not that bad. That's like the best answer I get these days. Like I was expecting maybe a little bit worse than that. But most people understand, like enough time's passed that they get it. And the people that don't like the price, then the next question is, well, hey, Matt, hey, Adam, how long am I going to have to wait to get this number? Like whatever the number is that's stuck in their head. And I think they're waiting years. Like I really do. So our biggest thing now, and this isn't a sales tactic. It's not like I truly believe what I'm saying. If you want to sell a condo at any point in the next 2 years, get it on the market now. It's not getting better in the short term. And we don't know when the market's going to bottom out. But even when it bottoms out, it's not just going to magically start going up the month after. Like it's probably going to bottom out and hover there for a period of time.
So it's funny because we put out an episode, I think, late last year of what do you wait for kind of April, May, which was traditionally the time to wait for to list, or do you list in January or early February? And our logic was exactly that. Beat the rush. And we had a really successful start to the year in terms of actually people being happy to be sold before there was this new glut of inventory. And I think it speaks to that point, right? We're seeing a bit of an uptick in Vancouver. I think June was kind of the first month of like across the board, things seem to be getting better. You know, part of the logic there I think you spoke to was like sellers are like, oh, that's actually, I was expecting that. Or man, I thought it might even be worse. So there's like a moment now where finally buyers and sellers are potentially on the same page, at least more so than they've been in years. But you still sound very pessimistic.
Yeah, like, no, like, listen, if you look at the overall market and properties that people actually want to buy, consistently now, every month this year, the new listings is down and the sales are up. Like, there is positive signs in our market. Like, if you took the under 500 square foot condos out of our market, the numbers would look pretty good. Like, it's just, there's such a massive amount of the active listing inventory that it's completely changing the narrative on the sales numbers. Because so much, like, I just feel like, yeah, this isn't great. Sales volume's low. But the things that we would watch, like absorption rate, months of inventory, new listings, active listings, sales. It's like, we've now had 5 months in a row that sales volume is up. Yeah, compared to a 30-year low. So there's not celebrate, but like it's early steps here and there's less listings coming to the market. Like if that remains for another year, year and a half, you eventually will see prices go up. And actually, like semi-detached homes in the areas that we talked about, they've bottomed. Like it's clear. Mm. They're going up and like they're not going crazy in value, but like they're going up. Good detached homes in choice neighborhoods are selling. And I don't know like percentage-wise if it's the same in both our markets, but there was just such a condo boom here for so long that you almost have to separate the condos from the freehold properties when you're talking about the market right now. Because if you put them together, really what you're saying is 70% of your statement is condos. Because that's our inventory. Like that is what's for sale.
So Tom, I'm just thinking here and we've experienced a significant downturn, probably, well, for sure, the largest downturn since you've been a licensed agent. And it would be hard to say, even if you were in your 60s and 70s and had been doing this for 40 years, I mean, which market do you reference as a worse downturn? It's really for every agent, right? What have been the biggest takeaways from this downturn? Like, what are the biggest lessons learned?
I think the biggest thing for me was that what I've learned in Toronto is the way that we built condos didn't create the housing anybody actually wanted. We built condos for investors and sold to investors, and that's the way they got built. Now, there's maybe a big conversation needs to happen on, can we change the model in which we build these properties in terms of not needing to get to a certain percentage of sold to get the construction financing so they can actually get off the ground sooner? Because right now, the only thing penciling or being built in our market is purpose-built rentals because of effectively the government incentive, what they're doing with removing the HST. And that was done, you know, a few years ago now. Or high-end luxury condos. So it's funny, like we've gotten to this point and we had this market that went up and down and sideways and then down again. And we're coming out of it. And I'd say like my biggest takeaway with the downturn is I'm kind of worried we're just going to do it again. Like eventually investors will come back. Nobody else is building anything. The government's bailing out all the developers right now. This isn't like there's a lot of like different ways you could look at that, but that is what's happening. You know, in Vancouver, how it's happening is more clear. In Toronto, it's like they're removing the HST. So it's not the government buying it all, but it's the reason they're actually selling. So I think what I've learned is like bigger family style floor plans and specific neighborhoods. If I'm investing my money in real estate moving forward, that's all I would be focused on.
The other thing I think about too is the condos in Vancouver is like how many people want the ground oriented in Toronto versus condos? Because like I'm thinking about larger condos in sure, it's better than having a one bed listed, but condos are fairly challenged across the board, even if they're larger footprints. Like, do you think there's just have we really embraced the condo for young families and for the middle, or is it more ground-oriented housing needed?
I think it's absolutely more ground-oriented housing, but we don't have any land here.
Right.
Like either do you guys. It's just like we can complain and say they did it the wrong way. What options did they have? Right?
Of course.
Like I think, you know, you look back at like a lot of the condo communities, like these big master plan communities when they launched, at least in like the marketing, they would show you that it's like family oriented and they were building a park and you'd have some daycares and some of the buildings and all this stuff. And it's like, they were built around this community idea, but most of the units were still relatively small. So I think that's what we learned, is like the actual living space, the footprint probably needed to be more specifically towards people that were going to live there, because smaller units still rent out fine. Renters, it's not that they don't care, but they were less like picky about it. They're like, yeah, I'm going to be here for a year. It's close to my work. My favorite gym's over there. I'll rent this place for $1,800 a month, right? But they're just, to sell them again to someone else that isn't just looking at the numbers is very, very difficult.
What about the maintenance fees there? Because I feel like the other thing that consistently comes up right now here, and I think we have some of the lowest maintenance fees in North America, as I understand, in Vancouver. But just thinking about, people often cite Toronto as like, oh, you think our maintenance fees are high, you should see Toronto's type thing. Like, it strikes me as if you're paying 800 or 1,000 or 1,200 bucks or whatever these kind of family homes and condos are. Like, if you're actually looking at what that does to your mortgage payment, like it's actually, you know, a semi-detached or detached, actually maybe with a suite, is actually a smarter buy.
Yeah.
Like I feel like, for sure. What are the maintenance fees? Like, what's an average, like with the stamp, you know, you mentioned this stamp checklist.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what is a good maintenance fee in that situation?
So our maintenance fee on stamp checklist, if your maintenance fees are under $1 per square foot, you get a tick. So so 800 square feet. Now this includes a parking spot, because you pay maintenance on the parking spot as well and the locker. So roughly, I would say when I started my career 13-ish years ago, I was seeing most maintenance was 60 to 70 cents a square foot. Something happened during the pandemic, like everything. They went up across the board like crazy in every building. And so I used to say like over $1 a square foot worries me. Now I'm like, just under $1 a square foot probably is okay, depending on the age of the building. But there's some buildings in Toronto that are, there's one specific one, and I don't want to like throw them specifically under the bus here, but it's in the St. Lawrence Market area. It was built in 2017. It's not that old. Their maintenance fees are currently $1.30 a square foot.
Yikes.
I would never, ever recommend anybody buying that building.
Just thinking, Adam, like that's on a 1,000 square foot two bed, you're at $1,300 a month. Yeah.
That's a good mental math.
But that's a couple hundred thousand dollars in mortgage, right? Like just every month going out. Anyway, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, Adam.
Okay. So when I first got into real estate, the average price per foot in Vancouver was 37 cents a foot. And I haven't looked recently, but I'd say we're probably closer to maybe 60, 70 cents a foot. Would you say, Matt, now?
Yeah.
But my understanding, so we were also late to the game with depreciation reports or reserve fund studies. And the way I had it explained to me many years ago was that Ontario and Alberta, at least, were better planners around contingency funds. Whereas Vancouver was very, like, we kind of always had the buildings were, we ran with very low funds, and we were often a special levy market. Are a lot of these in Ontario, would you say a lot of the repairs are taken out of the CRF, or like, are these fully funded buildings? Cause then it maybe makes a lot more sense, right?
Yeah. It's a good question that, like, it would be interesting if someone did a full like breakdown on this, to go just like percentage wise, size of building and all those different factors. What's the average in the reserve fund, which we would call it here, versus what you guys have? A special assessment, although they do happen, absolutely, it's not as common as maybe you see in the YouTube comments. Like, normally when repairs are done in buildings, it's taken from the reserve fund. There are some older buildings that do special assessments. There was one, actually, a condo that we sold. Each unit paid $109,000 for a special assessment. And it was to redo all the windows in the building, but it was a 45-year-old building, and they decided that was the path they were going to go. Most buildings, the reserve funds are fairly healthy. And I don't know, like, maybe if our condos are, I guess our condos wouldn't even really be bigger than yours or have more units, it'd be pretty comparable. But most of the time, we're seeing millions of dollars in the reserve fund when we're looking at the strata documents.
See, I'm always, that says everything right there, doesn't it, Matt?
Yeah, no kidding. I was just going to say that's exactly, so it sounds like basically the costs are almost the same. It's just how you're funding the maintenance costs, essentially.
Yeah, like is a special assessment pretty common? Is that like a normal thing?
We're playing Russian roulette over here.
Really? Okay.
Oh man, you want to replace the carpets on a 3-story building? There's a special assessment.
Yeah, it's very much well. And so, I mean, I don't want to say that because we have changed a lot. Like the depreciation, the introduction of the depreciation report was, I think, a really good thing for our market because a lot of buildings were running blind, resting on their laurels. It was a very like it was a. You know, and then you would have these buildings where they'd be at close to the 25-year mark or a mark where they were kind of getting where major expenses were coming. And then you'd have a buyer that would buy into it and maybe in the first 3 years of ownership get hit with something dramatic, like a $40,000 assessment or something like that, right? So yeah, and also a lot of buildings and a lot of stratas were just neglecting or deferring work, right? So now we're in a position where we're doing a better job, but it's kind of been a long road getting there. And I think that's why we've seen a dramatic increase. Like we have the mandatory now 10% contribution to the CRF annually. And now we're starting to see some buildings that are doing more than that based on depreciation recommendations. So it's interesting, but I think we're moving towards a model like you or like Toronto. However, that concerns me because there's a lot of people that are complaining about 60 cents a foot right now on a maintenance fee.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's interesting. Like special assessments obviously exist here. They happen, but it's not as common as it sounds like it would be in your market. I'd be curious to get your guys' opinion on this. So one of the big things we always focus on with our like first-time home buyers buying condos is let's not buy in investor buildings because they're 80% rented out and the person beside you renting is not the problem. It's like when you want to sell in 5 years and investors quicker to dump it than an end user. But if 85% or 90% of a building in Vancouver was bought by investors, wouldn't you just have a board of absentee? Like they technically own the unit, but most of the board members don't even live in the building. Like they're not, so they wouldn't be as involved. Like is that then worrying in the future?
We just had a couple guys on from First Service Residential, and we were like, what are the things if you were buying that you'd look for? And that a lot of people don't think, you know, it's like how much in the contingency, that type of thing. And that was one of the points they made was, is it hard to get quorum? You know, right. Like how active is the council? And it makes a lot of sense, right? Because not even that investors are, you know, I think people think, at least in my experience over the years, people think of like parasitical investors or like they're unwilling to put any money into the buildings and that's the problem. And I don't necessarily see that. I think it's just a level of engagement or lack of engagement.
Yeah.
That's probably the problem. Like I know I am involved in a condo building in East Vancouver. And every time I talk to the building manager, he's like, well, come to the meetings. No one comes to the meetings. Like we've never seen you at the meetings. And I'm like, shh. And
whenever I
go on my day.
Whenever I meet with a condo seller, normally if they're on the board, they'll tell me very early in the meeting and then they'll go on a 5-minute tangent about something that's going on that's not good. Like the difference in the meetings between condo sellers not on the board that don't pay attention to the people that are on them are wildly different.
So another thing that used to exist in our market that doesn't exist anymore, and it's kind of frustrating, but we used to get on the Form B document, which is like a snapshot of the building, we would get a percentage of rentals in the building. And it was useful because sometimes, you know, it would allow you to shape kind of an understanding of like the more kind of investor-oriented buildings versus end-user buildings. And now they don't do that anymore. And that changed probably 5 years ago.
Wait, why did they not do that?
I think it was a province that made that change.
Yeah, it was.
And I think it was because it stigmatized renters was the logic.
Huh.
Yeah. Am I making that up? I don't know. I think literally.
That sounds like a BC rule change to me. That sounds pretty normal.
It was at the provincial level and it made zero sense to anyone. And I think that was the logic.
See, that's like in our market, rentals go on MLS. So we can just look and be like, there's been 64 rentals in the last 2 years. Like there's probably mostly renters here, right?
Yeah,
like it's pretty obvious. You can't really hide from it.
But I wonder also, because I would say that a lot of the buildings that in downtown say, you know, it would still be roughly 50-50, right? Like it would be like, it would be surprising to see a building that would be like 80% investor owned.
Really in Vancouver?
I think so. If you were to look,
like, that would be pretty normal here for all the new ones.
And here, just in real time, because we can, Bill 44 kicked rental restrictions in 2023. And so since strata corporations can no longer restrict long-term rentals at all, the old Form B disclosure fields, number of units rented became meaningless. It was meaningless, I guess, in the way that they thought if there was like a max of 30% rental, then you'd see, they're at the max of the number of rentals. So they weren't actually doing it to gauge whether this is a good buy as an owner occupant. So they removed it, but it took that away because that was a very useful thing to have.
You know, what is interesting too, now I think about it, in our MLS system, when we set clients up on like the automatic searches, it doesn't allow us to choose to not send them tenanted properties. Like there is a workaround that you can figure it out pretty easily. But like the way the system is built is it doesn't allow you to only say vacant or owner occupied. You have to show them all of them on the automatic search, which I guess is some regulatory thinking as well.
Interesting.
Huh. Yeah, we definitely can't do that either. There's definitely no way for us to, we can't even just do freehold on MLS, which is weird. We have to send leasehold.
Really?
As well. Yeah. Don't ask me why.
Wow. Interesting. I use interface. So it's and you can obviously do that.
You can do that for interface, but you can't do it on MLS, which is strange. But
I thought you could add title, but someone will correct us or not, I'm sure. Hey, Tom, maybe as a final question here, a little forecasting moving forward here. Do you see, like, what do you think here for the next 1 to 3 years in the Toronto market?
Yeah, I think for freehold properties, they're close to bottoming if they haven't already for most neighborhoods. Of course, like the undesirable stuff will sit on the market and the overpriced stuff. But in general, I feel pretty confident about that outlook. I don't expect them to go up rapidly anytime soon either. But I also think that most of the drops have probably happened based on what we're seeing on ground level. I think for condos, you have to break it into different sizes and all the other things that we talked about today. I don't really see a world where let's talk like general condo market, just to make it easy. I don't really see a world where condo prices go up in any way that would make a difference to anybody's life until 2029. I do think there's opportunities, but I will say like there's what's been encouraging because we do work with a lot of first-time home buyers as well is when I take a call with a first-time home buyer and we talk through the criteria and I say, okay, I just want to let you know there's a chance you could buy this condo and it could go down in value in the first like year or 2 years that you own it. So you should own this for at least 5 years. And every single person will be like, no, we get it. So they're not as, you know, like most buyers are just worried. They don't want, that's the biggest sticking point for most people, right? Like even people that want prices to go down, they want it to go down so they can enter, but they want proof that it stopped going down before they enter. And I've seen enough people and they're like, oh no, we're going to own this minimum 5 years. Whether they do is a life situation thing, but at least the mindset going in where I have been encouraged to see. So I think over the next at least 3 years, I think sales volume for sure has bottomed out, which is can't really get too much worse than it was last year. So maybe that's not saying much, but you're slowly seeing things coming back. And if those trends that we mentioned earlier, if new listings continue to be down on a year-over-year basis and sales volume is at least even, if not going up, is which we've seen and that maintains, I think eventually you'll see a leveling off here. But what I'd be very curious to see is for both of our markets is a lot of people talk about when it's going to bottom out. I want to know, like, is it actually ever going to stay sideways? Like, have you guys ever seen a perfectly sideways market? I haven't. I want to know, like, if we bought them and then trade sideways, even if for 3 years, which would be wonderful for my life. It'd be nice to work in that market. I just don't know. I don't know. Like, we'll see what happens. Maybe it goes down and trades sideways for a little bit and then slowly grows again. Or it really does truly go sideways for a few years, because that's a market that I haven't worked in before.
Yeah, and you're right. Every market presents new challenges, but the sideways one might be the easiest.
It should be nice, like, not to work in an extreme, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
no, let's find a little bit of middle balance here.
The other thing that I'm just thinking of, going back to your point about investors kind of coming back into the market, which we've seen a little bit of as well, but they're coming back in with a different goal or a different property type in mind, right? So it will be interesting to watch how that, you know, we've talked a lot about the condo market, but how the bifurcation that's kind of takes place over the next 3 to 5 and maybe even into 8 to 10 years, where investors come back, maybe not at the level they were, but they have very different ideas of what they want to own in mind. So it's going to be interesting to watch that investor grade stuff and how long it sits.
It's a good point, because investors are definitely less than 10% of my business, maybe 5%. Like, so they're not coming back massively, but we are helping a few. They don't want to buy new construction unless they can get some developer inventory at really good deals, because the HST change that we had here. They're looking to buy resale. And I will say, most of them have pretty healthy amounts of cash to put down. So this isn't like, you're still not, even at today's prices, you're not investing with 20% down and breaking even on your asset. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a 35%, 40% to get to that range. And without guaranteed appreciation in the future, with like a huge question mark on when that's going to happen, you know, I just think it's still going to take some time. But you're seeing early signs of people asking questions, sniffing around, being like, hey, if you find this, send it to me. I'm having a lot of those calls. So I think there's like early signs that the first movers are slowly coming back.
Tom, we've kept you longer than we said we would, but we do have this segment called the 5-Wire, 5 lighthearted questions that we end every show with. Can you stick around for that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Question number one, one book that you would recommend for our listeners?
Oh, Project Hail Mary.
Project Hail Mary.
Have you seen, and the movie's out right now too.
Oh, who's in the movie?
Ryan Gosling.
Oh, I'm unfamiliar with this at all.
He was like the biggest movie of the year. Biggest movie of the year. The earth is dying. The sun is dwindling, and we got to go find, we got a Project Hail Mary, and he goes to space to save us, and lots of things happen. Oh, and if you're an audiobook person, the audiobook, the narrator that does it, it's like amazing. Like, such a good book and great movie as well.
Really?
Yeah.
And is this a long fiction drive or nonfiction today, Tom?
This is not real. No. It's the same guy that wrote The Martian, which became a movie as well. Right, same author. Yeah.
Same director, I think, of the movie too, right? Isn't it? I don't know.
The Martian, was Ridley Scott. This was, I'm blanking on that. Lord and Miller. It's two guys that did this one.
All right.
Nice.
Second question for you, Tom. Is there what new belief, behavior, or habit since you've been on the show have you adopted that's had a positive impact on your life?
I'm going to give you the lamest answer you've ever had on this already. I'm turning 35 in a week, and stretching has become a big part of my life.
No, that's a smart one.
I'm turning 45 in
so
2 months.
So you're an active stretcher then.
I'm not still, but I hope to be by the time I'm 55. So we'll see.
Yeah. If I could go back, that would be one thing I would probably adopt. I haven't adopted it yet, but I would.
Okay, question number three. What are you binge watching these days, or a TV recommend or a movie recommendation?
I can't give the same answer, but you should watch the Project Hail Mary movie as well. What are we binge watching? I don't even know if we've got a show going on right now. Let me think. I'll come back to that answer.
Yeah. Well, while you're thinking about that, Tom, when you're not listening to audiobooks driving around the big smoke, what music are you bumping right now?
I like anyone that, like Noah Kahan probably would be like that, like Mumford & Sons, Noah Kahan, that kind of music, that like kind of folky stuff. I'm into that.
So he doesn't have the subwoofer in his vehicle like you do, Matt, but nothing's bumping.
It's not bumping like
it's not bumping, but
Dubstep didn't make a comeback yet.
Last but not least, Tom, something that you have spent under, and we're going to increase this because last time I think we said $1,500, but something you've purchased for under, say, $5,000 recently that has had a positive impact on your life.
Oh, I mean, my entire business and all the videos we make are off this laptop, which was like fully loaded at the time, this Apple laptop for $4,000. Like if you look at actual, like it doesn't have to be a Mac computer, it can be any computer that does what you need. Amount of money spent versus output I get from it, it's not even close. This is the best thing that I have spent money on.
That's a great one.
That is a great one, especially considering that we started this with my microphone not working and me explaining that my entire laptop is in Spanish. Because
you know what?
Actually,
I'll give you another one. Having someone build out this studio in my basement to do these videos was actually probably the best money spent on ROI.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. And you do everything from your basement then?
Pretty much. Yeah. I joke with people that when I started my career, I lived in my parents' basement and now I make videos, but it's my own basement.
Hey, yeah. that's called success, Tom.
Yeah. That's come a long way.
we're still operating out of our parents' basement. So anyways, we'll leave it there, guys. Tom, how can people find out more about what you're up to?
If you like this kind of stuff, you want to listen to a podcast that's Toronto and Vancouver, Tom Story Show. You can just type my name into YouTube for all the other videos.
Fantastic.
Right on. Well, thanks. Thanks again for your time, Tom. That was as expected. Great conversation.
Thanks, guys. That was fun.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Tom Story from Royal LePage in Toronto and co-host, of the Tom Story Show.
Yeah, Matt, really enjoyed that conversation. Always great having Tom on the show. We've been on the Tom Story Show a couple times. I've been on, you've been on. This is Tom's second appearance on our show, and Steve Crash will be making his first appearance in the coming weeks. So can't wait for that. Anyways, great conversation and always a pleasure.
Absolutely. I love how he does things like the stamp, you know, like the stamp acronym. I love acronyms like that. You know, it just simplifies things in a very useful way. Adam, one more point before we go. Well, one about Toronto and Vancouver. It is shockingly, the market seems shockingly similar.
Right.
Very, very similar, which is very interesting at this point. And two, Adam, and I quote from the AI overview in Google, the floor is uniquely cushioned with a thick layer of coiled horsetail hair beneath the wood to absorb impact and provide its signature bounce. That is, of course, in reference to the Commodore Ballroom in downtown Vancouver, referencing back from the introduction of the show.
Yeah, and I'm just on a Reddit thread because I wanted to know more. This Reddit user says, I ended up in a debate amongst friends last night. Does anyone know how much horsehair is underneath the Commodore Ballroom dance floor? Google doesn't dive into the details. I'm saying it's around 500 horses worth of hair, which seems kind of crazy. And when we're talking about hair, like, is this like the glue factory? Like, where are we getting this hair from? And
I think it's horse tail. Google says horse tail hair. So they just, okay. But can you imagine, you know, I'm not saying, you know, I have interesting conversations with friends, but debating how much horse hair is under the floor of the Commodore Ballroom is not exactly an exciting conversation, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah. Well, no, Vancouver Magazine also did a whole thing on it, Matt, which this should really be for our horsehair podcast, which we do every Tuesday. But anyways, it does say there's it's one of the horsiest dance floors on in Vancouver. So we'll cut for the week, Matt, but how can...
You heard it here first. We will cut for the week. If you just obviously say it every week, we love working with people who listen to this show. We've worked with hundreds of you over the years and always excited to talk to more people. You can head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com where we have buyers and sellers resources. You can also try me at any time at 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or that Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, everyone. And we're back here in 2 weeks with another great episode. We'll see you then.
2,000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.